I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root Artist feature presented in conjunction with the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. I have the pleasure today of speaking with author, curator, historian, and scholar, Sarah Lewis. Sarah, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you in. Your latest book, I have it here in front of me. Mm-hmm. Your book is entitled The Rise, Creativity, the Gift of Failure, and the Search for Mastery. What inspired you to write this book?
So many things. I'll tell you three. Working in the arts, I've always seen that creativity is a mystery, how it comes about, what gives rise to it. But I noticed that when you start to understand the gifts that come from moving through difficult circumstances, you get closer to understanding the process. I began writing the book, though, organically when I was a teenager. I would look at the life stories of iconic individuals and just notice that there were really uncommon foundations on which they built their own rises, whether it was Martin Luther King or J.K. Rowling, Oprah Winfrey, people like this. And I had this moment where I wondered, and I really feared in a way, that if I didn't let myself take enough risk and potentially fail, that I might not become my fullest self. So it was an interest. I wrote about it for my college application essay about my own failures. And as I developed, I realized that it was the one thing we're never taught and that we must learn to understand. The one thing I didn't see in the world and wanted to be there for the next generation.
Who is this book for? As I read the book, I kept thinking to myself, who is she speaking to with this text? So who is the book for?
There's no one that the book is not for. And I think that's what's so interesting about the response it's receiving. I wrote it as a bit of an homage to the MFA students that I work with at Yale. There are always these back-turn paintings and artist studios, works that they don't want to show you, but they're not going to burn either, you know,
right,
that get them to the work that they do want to show you. And that's a lot of what this book is about. It's also for wildly successful entrepreneurs and who always have a failure that they likely will discuss with you. It's for young folks, and it's for people who are really trying to create a new path for themselves, ultimately.
One of the things or the notions that I've been really thinking about since I've read the book, one of the notions that you touched on very early on is this notion of mastery versus perfection.
Yes.
And I really enjoy the distinction that you made there. Could you share or elaborate a little bit more on that?
Oh, sure. I love this distinction. It seems as if what we think we're always aiming for is success. But in fact, as I see it, as I sit here as a curator, I think what propels us is actually the unfinished, the sense of being on a journey, the sense of knowing that there's always more to do. We thrive, you know, not when we get it done, but when there is more to do. Mastery is about that journey, ultimately. Mastery is not the same as success. I think success is a label that the world confers on you when you hit a kind of status level, which in fact doesn't always match how people feel that they're doing internally. Mastery is about a very internal landscape. It's driven by that gap between where you are and where you want to go that works as a dynamic that works throughout a lifetime. And mastery is distinct from perfectionism. I think perfectionism is a pursuit of an inhuman goal. Right, something that is not really meant for us to attain. Mastery is what it looks like when someone like Paul Cézanne's work is heralded, yet he doesn't want to sign 90% of his paintings because they don't yet meet his goal. You know, it's mastery is what Duke Ellington lived out when he was asked, "What's your favorite song?" And he said, "Always the next one, always the one I have yet to do." That's the difference between perfectionism and mastery. It's this propulsion that comes from a creative ongoing journey. It's what I call the sort of ever onward almost of life.
In your book, you go through a lot of examples that I think people would maybe overlook. And I think that you're able to bring some perspective from these often overlooked examples, whether they be the archers at Columbia mm-hmm. or scientists who have gone on to create or discover these really great properties of carbon, or people who take a risk, like the gentleman who crafted the blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in all of these different stories that you've brought together,
mm-hmm.
I wonder about your process of mm-hmm. amassing all of these stories,
yeah.
all these perspectives. So talk about your process for wrapping your arms around all of this work, especially because it does span a lot of ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the question. My process for this was in a way similar to a curatorial process. The question I always ask myself when I'm curating is, what are we failing to see? And how can I give a platform to that? Better said, what are we failing to see and what should we see that we're not? So what that required in this case was being very present, being very aware of when a story was in front of me that needed to be part of the narrative. Sometimes it would be a sort of a sensation I would get, a kind of a thrill, a sort of chill, but I would really let myself be free to follow my imagination, my curiosity. And that became a sort of methodology, a kind of research. You know, why am I so fascinated by these archers? Why am I fascinated by how they show the distinction between success and mastery? Success being able to hit the 10 ring once, and mastery being able to do it as they do for 3-hour practices again and again, seeing yourself as an archer who can hit a 7 but can also hit a 10, an 8, and then a 9. And at a certain point, you have to trust that if you yourself are intrigued by something, then likely other people might be as well. So that led me to writing about Frederick Douglass, looking at the power of aesthetic force, as he described it during the Civil War, to be able to help our nation see our own failures more clearly, to Franklin Leonard, writing about the blacklist and Nobel Prize winners. And the last thing I'd say is, when you start to write about contemporary artists, which is not an easy thing to do, you gain facility to kind of write about a lot of things. So it wasn't too difficult to write about topics that were sort of outside of my realm of normal expertise.
All right. Now, you mentioned in your notes that the chapter on the Polar Explorer
mm-hmm.
was harder for you than some of the other chapters mm-hmm. in the book. And I wondered, as I read that, if there was some analogy between you and the real life protagonist of that chapter and what you were going through in that time when you were writing that.
Oh, that's interesting. I love that you read the notes, first of all. That's great. So Arctic Summer, the chapter you're referring to, is about Ben Saunders, this polar explorer, who is the first person in the world to go to the North Pole and now the South Pole back on foot, solo, without assistance. This is an arduous feat, right, for anyone physically. But what gripped me about his journey in the North Pole expeditions was that he had to encounter what psychologically is almost debilitating, when it's not, the Arctic is not just one giant ice sheet. For the benefit of our audience, I'll just describe it.
Sure, sure.
It's multiple sheets of ice that are constantly moving. And so he'd often find that as he would walk a whole day, 12 hours in sub 50 degrees Celsius temperatures, trudging with 200-pound sledge on his back, he was often erasing his gains from the day because the ice would be floating the opposite direction that he'd want to go. He would sleep to revive himself. And then, of course, when he would wake up, he could find that he had drifted backwards the entire night. How do you handle this, right? The Arctic is the size of the United States, completely depopulated, just him out there. So there was a part of me that identified with that pursuit of something that might elude your grasp despite how much you go for it, because writing is like that. The chapter on him embodied that process. I spent 2 years trying to understand what it was that really powered him, only to find that it was the exact opposite of what I thought it was. It was surrender, ultimately, you know. Not a giving up, but in a spiritual sense, giving over to what's the fact of what is your circumstance in that moment. you know. And by releasing resistance, gaining access to the resources that you need to continue on. And writing was like that. Once I stopped resisting the story or resisting, once I stopped putting my own frame on something and let what needed to arise, arise, I found my way through. So there was a lot of resonance. I did write myself into that chapter to do with loss and grief, to describe how I felt that surrender operated for me. It's maybe the only time I really wrote myself into the chapter. It is the most rewarding one. Once I finished it, I knew that I had really, no matter what happened, I had really finished the book.
In one of the last chapters, well, actually, I think the last chapter on grit, you really gave a really detailed account of Samuel Morse.
Mm-hmm.
And as an inventor and an artist, I was curious about why you chose Samuel Morse over, let's say, someone who came before him, like Ben Franklin, mm-hmm. or someone who came after him, like mm-hmm. Thomas Edison.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about Morse and his journey that really spoke to you as the subject for that chapter?
Yeah. Well, I always say, I people ask me oftentimes, you know, how did you write this book as an art historian or as someone in the arts, because it is so broad? And I say I couldn't have written this book without being in the arts, because people understand the importance of failure when it comes to creativity instinctively, but they don't always look at it as it pertains to the rest of life. Samuel Morse embodies that journey. What people don't typically know that I did as an art historian was that he was only able to invent the telegraph because he spent 26 years as a painter, a failed painter in his mind. And I guess objectively, too, he couldn't support his family. He was rejected without hope of appeal, was the quote from Congress for all the commissions that he wanted. When he toured his work, the exhibition of them put him into debt. You know, it's a sort of classic story. But I loved how vivid the transformation from the failed pursuit of painting to the telegraph was. He literally took the stretcher bars of his canvas and transformed that into the first model for the telegraph. So what was a discard, what was something failed, became the foundation for something not just successful or triumphant, but the foundation for the communications revolution as we know it.
Going back to your voice in the book,
mm-hmm.
to me it seemed like there was a crescendo of your voice from the beginning of the book towards the end. I felt like the very beginning of the book, it was more of you threading all of these stories together,
mm-hmm.
these quotes together, these perspectives together. But I felt like towards the end, it was more you
mm-hmm.
giving more of your first person perspective in the book. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really astute read of it. And I now have enough distance from the process to say that that is accurate. And what you're seeing, me sort of throwing off in a way, the shackles of scholarship, what it means to write with the constant knowledge of who's come before you and what they have said and who you want to honor, moving from that place to one of freedom to be able to honor my own observations about the world enough to put my own voice in the foreground. That was one of the gifts of writing over the, you know, 3-4 years that it took to do the book. And the sequence of the chapters does show that. I will say, though, I didn't write the book in the sequence of the current chapters, but the order does reflect a kind of freedom that came from the process.
Going back to when I asked you about who was this book for, after I finished the book, I felt like this was a great book for policy influencers, because I think you weave a lot of stories together that cover a lot of ground. And for people who are involved in setting policy as it relates to the arts, this would be a really great read for them as they consider the role of the arts. I think we're talking a lot about STEM and going from STEM to STEAM. And I felt like this book was a really great place for some dialogue to happen in that context.
Mm. No, thank you for that. You know, that's, for me, it would be my sort of favorite audience for this book, people who are really able to help shift the way in which we support the arts and education. I've just come from D.C. where I gave a talk at the Aspen Institute, and I was thrilled to see the range in the audience, from policymakers to people that are in the arts to artists, all in one audience. Many people focused on pedagogy as well, teachers. But it is really a book that I hope can start to shift a conversation about the importance of the arts in education, the importance of supporting the arts outright, and what we need to be able to do regarding policy in all ways, whether it's regarding entrepreneurship and how it is that we support that in America more, and onward.
I think you mentioned also in the book, in the chapter on grit, that somehow from a testing perspective, we've gotten smarter.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten smarter as a country, but yet we have maybe become more limited in our ability to deal with what life brings us,
right,
both business-wise as well as, I guess, in a public sector way. Mm-hmm. Could you talk on that also?
Sure. So if you look at the way in which creativity is measured in education, the Torrance Test for Creative Thinking have shown a decline in creativity scores from the first time that testing began in 1968. And if you look at the same period, if you look at metrics for how we measure IQ and talent, those scores have all gone up, as have scores for confidence in American children. So it means that we are maybe smarter, maybe more confident, but less equipped to handle difficult problems, less equipped to be creative. And that's worrisome for a country that's openly focused on innovation. I think what's also interesting is if you look at some of the scholarship that's come out of Michigan State University, Robin Root Bernstein has a great study when he looks at many Nobel Prize-winning scientists and others and their avocations. They typically have a higher rate of avocations in the arts than the rest of the population, right? So people that are inventing tend to find different skills and ways of looking at the world from having hobbies of being musicians or painting or doing other things. But yet we tend to be fearful when our young people say they want to be an artist or they're in elementary school. But yet what the studies are showing is that it is beneficial, full stop. There's no reason to not support it. It's to our detriment that we don't. So I write about that in this chapter called The Grit of the Arts. What that chapter is also seeking to do is to remind us of how much hard work goes into being an artist, right? It's the arts are often seen as a kind of respite from life, a luxury, something we consume on weekends. And the idea is to remind people of the labor involved. And the main point of that chapter is also to highlight what the arts teach that I think really nothing else does, which is discernment, you know, and agency, the ability to know when to shift course and when to keep on your path. When young people are taught the arts, it's really the one time, when I say young, I mean, you know, middle school, elementary school, it's the one time where their own internal compass is what's guiding their path, right? There's no answer they're looking to get in, say, a math class or a science class. No teacher can tell someone that their lines are too thick or that their lines are too thin, right? All you can do is help people close that gap between where they are and where they want to be. You can help someone see if their effect is really getting close to their intention or not. But that student has to figure out what feedback to listen to and what to ignore. And that's what's so powerful, I think, for young people.
I would love to get your perspective on the role of the public intellectual and being able to put your voice in that public forum. And as an African-American woman, mm-hmm. I think this is important, mm-hmm. that when we talk about the thinkers of mm-hmm. of our society, there are not that many African-American women who I believe come to mind readily mm-hmm. off the top of a lot of people's heads. So for you, with this book, with your subsequent work, what does that mean to you to be a part of this conversation?
You know, I will admit, I'm someone who focuses more on the work, less how I'm seen. So I haven't given myself a lot of time to really think through what it means to perhaps be becoming a public intellectual, because it wasn't a goal that I had. It's born out of this, a desire to make sure that we were all having a conversation about ideas to do with creativity, mastery, failure, and not just people in the arts. So I wrote a book that had a broad audience. It was really only when I wrote the book, or kind of halfway through, that I looked up and realized that most of my colleagues writing nonfiction books for a trade audience didn't look like me, you know, when I tried to find close comparables. And so I do feel increasingly excitement and responsibility. Excitement because I know that I'm not alone, despite the fact that I don't see myself in the sort of cousin books to my own, necessarily. I know how many other scholars are doing work like mine who should have the same platform. And I'm excited to continue to give voice to those colleagues through this work, whether it's through writing or being on stages with them, being on platforms like this with them. You know, so much of the work that we do in museums and in the academy, I think, should have a broader platform. So as social media develops, as different great podcasts like this are formed, I think it gives what should always have been public work its natural public home. You know,
I would love for you to put your art historian hat on. From an art historian perspective, when do you sense when innovation has happened?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So what curators and art historians spend a lot of time doing is being in artist studios. And as a curator, the exchange is often about, from the artist's perspective, is this curator going to give my innovative work a platform, right? And is there innovation in the artist's work is really what the curator is often asking themselves. I tend to have this sort of line in my mind when I'm in an artist studio, if I'm thinking about giving them a show of some kind. And it's about whether they are still scaling a mountain or if they are kind of at a plateau and if they're ready to scale again. And it's sometimes not necessarily the work that tells you if someone is in a period of innovation, but how the artist themselves is either what their posture is like, you know. If they are comfortable with it, if they feel as if they've closed that gap between their intentions and their effects, they're probably not really looking for a kind of validation, you know. But when they are, when they really want to know what you think of the experimentation at work, that for me is when I know that there's something innovative happening in their hearts and minds about the work. It's in part why I actually never do crits, so to speak, like critique work over the phone or online. I try to always do it in person because there are cues and there are ways that instinct works in person that can't work, you know, virtually. So in some ways, what I'm describing is very abstract and a little bit metaphysical because it's not necessarily that you can always see innovation in a work of art itself. It's oftentimes what you're able to sense about where someone still wants to go in their work vis-a-vis where they are that lets you know what can come, you know?
You mentioned crit as a notion in your book in the grit chapter. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you perceive the process of crit from an academic standpoint as it relates to what may happen in the world of social media where artists have a lot of feedback from a range of perspectives.
Right, right. No, it's an important question. I think the crit, for those who haven't seen one, and not everyone has, of course, it's such a unique, powerful process. In the academic context, it looks very different from the way it does in social media. If you would come to Yale and you see how we do it in photography or painting and printmaking, you'd see what it reminds me of, the sort of Yoruba trickster god Eshu Alegba, right? This idea of being able to walk around something that's full 360 degrees to really get a full sense of it before you describe what it is. Now, that occurs in the crit by faculty speaking about work for 45 minutes to an hour, students, the the person whose work is kind of on display, its colleagues also being present. So it's very performative, you know, and it's difficult to handle because it's so public. The artist often isn't really, not allowed, but isn't speaking very much during the crit. So they're just taking in all this feedback. The intention, though, in an academic context is for it to be helpful for an artist to close that gap between where they are and where they want to be. And it's given with that in mind. It's humane. It's meant to be beneficial, though it is critical. That, I think, is different from the social media context of a crit, where you have this binary like or just silence, right? You don't know what a like means. You don't know if they like just the way that Instagram has maybe put a filter on your image or the work itself. You don't know what state of mind the person was. You don't even know maybe who the person is who's liking the work. That's why I don't do crits online, or I don't do crits any other way, but in person, because I do think that it's a process that can't be replicated, what you have in that academic context online, I should say. You can replicate it for yourself, and most artists do when they leave programs, kind of replicate a crit for themselves by having colleagues in their studios, et cetera. But the final thing I'd say is that the momentum that's required to continue to make work can't really be propelled by likes on Facebook, you know. It's got to be propelled by true engagement, I think. So I would encourage people to make sure that they are not just buoyed up by support that they receive through social media.
As a historian, I would love to get your thoughts on the role of art in a more popular context now. I think we see a lot of very highly visible celebrities embracing art. Jay-Z comes to mind.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Being here in Atlanta, a lot of our art community goes to Art Basel down in Miami. Mm-hmm. And there's this role where art is now a very in thing for whatever reason, because the right person is pushing it, or mm-hmm. it's just that time. And
yeah.
then sometimes it recedes. Some things remain that may set the foundation for other movements or other mm-hmm. moments. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, from your perspective as an art historian, mm-hmm. what do you see about this current wave that may outlast the sort of in-crowdness of it right now, if mm-hmm. that makes any sense?
Sure. No, it does. Well, I think what will last, and it's what Frederick Douglass talked about that I wrote about in the chapter Beauty, Error, and Justice in the book, is that aesthetic force will always be a timeless phenomenon that will propel people to want to collect works that move them strongly. It will shift and catalyze social movements as it has. We forget, you know, is the broadside of the slave ship Brooks that really was finally what led to the abolition of slavery, right? The environmental movement with the photograph of Earthrise. Those moments will never change, but Of course, the what is collected will shift, and who's doing the collecting, of course, will shift. And it makes me think about James Baldwin. He had this great line in his essay, The Creative Process, and he said, a society must assume that it is stable, but the artist must know, and he or she must let us know that there is nothing stable under heaven. That's what the arts remind us. And so to ask a question about what is timeless becomes kind of meta in a way. So, because the arts are here to remind us that nothing really is, though dynamics will last. And the power of the arts, I think, is one of them. I could say more of it. I do about Jay-Z in particular and younger collectors starting to realize the importance of the arts. I think that's all to the good. So long as they are doing it for the right reasons. I was really honored to work with Jay-Z when I was the curatorial advisor to the Barclay Center when it opened in Brooklyn. And it was wonderful spending time with him and seeing just how knowledgeable he is about the works that I had proposed that ended up being approved, like Micheline Thomas and Jose Parla, for, you know, decades long lasting commissions. So if people have any concerns about kind of knowledge base of collectors, I don't think there's really, there should be much reason for that. I'm encouraged. Anything that we can do to support the arts encourages me, frankly.
Going back to your mission to bring art back to the forefront of how we see things in our society, mm-hmm. if you would give just some of your own personal recommendations or your wish lists or some of your goals about really making an impact in that space to make art or to reintegrate art back into, I guess, our cultural zeitgeist in a more formative way.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long do we have? I mean, really.
As long as you want.
You know, we spoke a little bit earlier about the first way, I'd say, which is to find a way to refund the arts and education in the U.S. There are great programs. Studio in a School is one of them that brings artists into public school systems around the country, but we can do better. We must do better, I think. Innovation requires it. Our souls require it. I don't imagine what any country would look like when all is said and done without its arts. I can't even imagine it. The second is I think we need to do a better job of finding ways to support the arts that isn't just built on individual patronage. You know, when I worked at the Tate Modern in the UK, it was nice to have a sense and security that there would be some municipal support, that there would be support that wasn't dependent on one or two or a largesse of people's views. You know, when you depend on the views of a patron and the financial support of a patron, it can shift your programming. There are things that can happen that I know many arts leaders are concerned about. So I would hope that we would revive a conversation about the need for robust arts for a robust nation at the federal level and at different state levels. I think finally I'd say that, and this is more of a kind of a family issue, but I think we need to have less fear of supporting the arts as a path. I would say, you know, I'll tell you just an anecdote. In my building, there was a mother with her two children, and she asked them, they were, you know, six or eight or so, she asked them what their favorite subject was, and the boy said art, and the girl said gym, and she looked at me, and she, as if to say, what am I going to do? And I almost wanted to say to her, don't look at me, I think this is fantastic that he wants to be an artist, and I can't wait to see what he does in his life, whether or not he becomes one, because anyone who has an inclination to see themselves as an artist probably is empowered in that moment to think that they can put something new into the world. So I should hope that we find more ways to support all the young people who have these dreams that are often squashed or quelched and instead should be supported.
My last question is about you personally. I read somewhere that you were a 400-meter sprinter, and that's a very interesting race because it's this really intense combination of speed and endurance. And I'm wondering, as you look at your current career trajectory now and where you're planning to take all that you're into and all that you're planning for yourself, do you see that as a fitting sort of maybe foretelling of the kind of path that you would be on?
So sharp, yeah. I've often thought that that race described me well, in part because I chose it deliberately due to the strengths that I have as a sprinter, but not the fastest sprinter, and as an endurance runner, but not the best endurance runner. Somehow the combination of those two things was great for that race. It does speak to how I'm living my life now. I do think I work in these two modes where I'll have a lot of endurance, take off time, this time 3 years really, to write this book and the other book that's coming out next year. And then I've had a period of kind of really sprinting, talking about it, being on the road with it as I am right now. But I enjoy both modes. And it's the way that I see my life working. Yeah, there's something about the sort of eternal quality of that circle, too. I'm just trying to do work that I hope is timeless. Yeah.
Sarah Lewis, author of The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure and The Search for Mastery. Sarah, let everyone know how they can learn more about you and what you have going on.
Sure. Well, they can visit my website if they like. It's my full name, sarahelizabethlewis.com. All my information is there, details about where you can buy the book or see me at an event maybe near you, given how much I'm traveling the country. But I love staying in touch with everyone who my work touches, so please feel free to reach out.
Sarah Lewis, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.